Food studies, we talk a lot about the right to food, food justice, food security, about identity and belonging, and about the control mechanisms of supply management or irrigation systems or food safety inspection. These are big concepts and very related to power, the power of collective sovereignty and freedom, and the power of control over the self. Welcome to Digesting Food Studies, the podcast that aims to hold onto your ears while freeing up your soul and mind and fingers, at least when it comes to the holistic and pluralistic field of food studies. I'm your benevolent and controlling host, David Santo, but you're the one with your finger hovering over the skip forward button. This episode is about indigenous food sovereignty, a concept that has been well-defined and well-discussed, yet still very challenging to make real. It's anchored to histories of oppression and exploitation and displacement, and it is central to the present and future of reconciliation. At a time when it seems that everything to do with domestic and international relations is up in the air, thinking and acting about sovereignty is wildly important. The article in focus this episode comes from Volume 8, Issue 2 of Canadian Food Studies, published in August 2021. We start, as ever, with Alexia Moyer's Amuse-Bouche feature, in which she shares a piece of history featuring the Lekwungen people of the West Coast, the camas plants they cultivated, the Hudson's Bay Company, and what settler colonials considered to be untouched nature. It is but one example of indigenous food sovereignty being trampled in the history of this place we call Canada. Then, our thematic conversation this episode is with Kaylee Micknick, co-author of a beautifully layered article on food systems education for youth and Indigenous food sovereignty in Garden Hill First Nation, Manitoba. Finally, wrapping things up, we hear from PhD candidate Courtney Vaughan, who shows us how food sovereignty and food systems engagement both support and drive one another. Well, hello, Alexia. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks, David.
Are you ready to go back in history a bit to explore Indigenous food sovereignty?
Yes, I brought you a bulb today.
A bulb. I'm going to tease a little bit to the audience. There's something that I know that they don't know yet, but we're going back like 200 years, and looking at how food sovereignty for Indigenous peoples in this place that we call Canada has been under attack for a long time.
Yes, yes.
So tell me more. Tell us more.
I'll tell you a little bit about this bulb called the camas or Camassia quamish. It's a member of the lily family and it's edible. Mm-hmm. And it bears a physical resemblance to an onion. It can be boiled or eaten raw or baked in a fire pit over several days. And the taste of the camas bulb has been described variously. The Oxford Companion to Food likens it to mealy potatoes, gingerbread, baked pears, maple sugar, quince, dates, and figs.
So it's sort of sweet, sort of granular, sort of a whole bunch of things, depending on your perspectives on taste.
Yeah, the undertone, I think, is the sweetness, which may be connected to the cooking method when it's baked.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I just had some salsify roots in a can, which were not at all delicious. My partner said, oh, these are just mushy and don't have much taste. But they do have a similar to a Jerusalem artichoke or a topinambour, that sort of slightly sweet, slightly not quite sure what it is, but I can get sort of what a camas might be. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
Well, I'm going to tell you a story, actually. And it's not my story. It's a story that was told by John Lutz in a chapter of a collection called Plants, People, and Places, The Roles of Ethnobotany and Ethnoecology in Indigenous Peoples' Land Rights in Canada and Beyond. This is edited by Nancy J. Turner, and it's published by McGill Queen's University Press. And it's a story of an encounter between the British explorers and fur traders and their fondness for the picturesque and a camas-inflected topography shaped by the Lekwungen people. The time period, as we said, is mid-1830s and 1840s. Now, the Lekwungen peoples are indigenous North American Coast Salish people who reside on southeastern Vancouver Island, British Columbia. And at the time of the encounter in question, their main source of protein was Pacific salmon. And in terms of carbohydrates, they ate quite a lot of camas. Now, while chemists are naturally occurring in this area, there was a great deal of human intervention involved in their production. Maintaining this diet involved careful land management. So in the spring, in April and May, when the bulbs flowered, the plants were marked out, separating the blue camas from the cream-colored ones. And these were called death camas or Zygodinus venenosus. So don't eat those ones because they'll kill you.
Sorry, I missed that. Don't eat the blue ones or don't eat the red ones?
don't eat the cream-colored ones.
The cream-colored ones.
You can eat the blue ones.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Woo, sorry. I blanked for a second. Now I'm totally paralyzed about eating camas that I find foraging. But so what you're saying is actually they were foraged plants, but they were also cultivated.
Yes.
There was a lot of land practice going on in their maintenance and enabling them to become then a food source.
Yes, and even in terms of the harvesting, there was a particular approach, a particular time of year between June and August. These were harvested. Only the larger bulbs were taken and special tools were used and required to properly and carefully take out the bulb. The seeds were gathered and then planted. And then once the bulbs were dormant, they lit fires. And so the burn would consume the dried grasses, the oak seedlings, invading shrubs, and provide fertilizer for the roots. So what it did is it created this open landscape with the occasional oak and pine tree groves. So the result was a pretty, but I really want to stress here, anthropogenic landscape. This is not a naturally occurring landscape. Meanwhile, the other side of the story, Hudson's Bay Company is looking for a new site for a headquarters depot. Their Vancouver fort had some drawbacks in terms of access, and they had already lost two supply ships at the mouth of the Columbia River. Their requirements were as follows: a safe and accessible harbor, water power, an abundance of timber, and the adjacent country well adapted for tillage and pasture farms. So over a six-year period, at least four expeditions were dispatched to find a site, and every harbor from the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca north to the Fraser River was examined with these requirements in mind.
Well, they were desperate to find a landing site. There was a lot of money involved, I guess.
Yeah, they did. And they found Kamasak, which means rush of water, or what was eventually to become Fort Victoria, which met all of these requirements. And its key advantage, according to W.H. McNeil, James Douglas, Bertold Seaman, and William Gordon in their writings, was its successions of plains with groves of oaks and pine.
Mm-hmm. Not noticing that there was a lot of stuff growing under the ground.
Exactly. And they're all using the same kind of vocabulary to describe the place. One describes it as a perfect Eden, a perfect Elysium, or one could hardly believe that it was not a work of art. And as enchantingly beautiful as the most elegantly furnished pleasure grounds in England.
That's extraordinary. So we really are talking about a very human-made landscape, but mm-hmm. to the view of the colonizers, it was, in air quotes, a naturally beautiful place.
Exactly. And we have explorers, naturalists, a fur trader, and a mariner, and they're all kind of aware of and drawn to this idea of the picturesque. They were noticing particular characteristics, a particular set of aesthetic qualities that reminded them of home. But the irony is that the home landscapes to which they refer were manufactured. They were tended to, but they did not see this landscape as anything other than naturally occurring.
Yeah, once again, this idea of the wild, the untouched.
Yes, and I love this line from Lutz. He describes it, the fact that they discursively and cartographically emptied the landscape.
One of the many terrible purges that Europeans have committed here.
The second irony is that ultimately the tillable land that they thought they had found was not quite adapted to their purposes, and they found it further on in the forest areas beyond. But their increasing presence in the area challenged food sovereignty of those who had occupied the land for thousands of years. And in its place, they built a pretty English village named after a queen, the English one, and not the queen root of this climb, which is how the Salish described Camas.
Oh, that's terrible and beautiful at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you want to read the whole article, please go and see the original in this amazing book.
We'll include it in the show notes. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Haley Micknick is a food studies scholar and practitioner who has researched food sovereignty, school food programs, and urban and rural food issues. A registered dietitian to boot, she brings a holistic, systems-based approach to all her work, as well as a clear consciousness about how Indigenous and non-Indigenous people can work together in respect and mutual support. Well, Kaylee, thank you so much for joining us here on Digesting Food Studies. I'm very excited to dive into this article. It's actually from a number of years back, but still holds a lot of really relevant and fascinating details. Can you tell us just in a few words what it is about, although it is, of course, about many things?
Thank you so much, David, and it's a pleasure to be here speaking about this piece. What this article really is about, to me, is to highlight the voices of both First Nations youth and elders living in Garden Hill First Nation and their desires for food sovereignty in their community and the importance of youth, particularly their voices and their ideas for the future.
And even the title of the article lists quite a number of different elements that are within this article, within the research that you've done, including youth education, including the connections between hearts and minds and bodies and spirits, including the multiply layered issue of Indigenous food sovereignty and the histories of colonialism and racism that have undermined sovereignty in many places, and also the complexities of food in the provincial north. And then layered onto that, you've got a really fascinating methodology that involves also some pretty distinctive tools. So I was wondering if you could tell me what you think is distinctive about this text and why it's important for people to read it now, maybe a few years after it's been published.
That was such an excellent summary of the work. I don't think I could have said it better. I love how you put it with all the different layers that I think when you're in the research, sometimes you don't even see it for what it is until, you know, I'm reading this now. And actually looking back, I'm like, I do feel pretty proud of the work. It was quite an undertaking at the time. And when if you want to talk about that methodologically, what it did involve was a lot of time spent in the communities. And I was fairly new to the context of food insecurity in northern Manitoba at the time. And so I had spent a summer essentially living on Garden Hill First Nation, which is a remote flying community in Manitoba. And that experience of living on an isolated reserve community with the strengths and the beauty of that area and of the people, but in contrast with the poverty and food insecurity, it was very stark and unsettling at the time and still is. But what this paper, I think, really does show is the inspiration and the way moving forward for basically local-based solutions that are so important to really get at the deep root of these large structural issues. And I think speaks to when you talk about the body, soul, and heart, that's really the engagement of the healing work that can be done through food and in these communities. But with the methods, spending as much time in the community as I did, one thing that's not focused a lot on this article, but was really instrumental to my understanding, was spending 2 weeks canoeing with elders in northern Manitoba, sort of in between the Island Lake First Nations, with the wish to document through GIS story mapping a traditional canoe route that community members would have taken to travel in between the communities upwards up until about the 1950s. And it was through that experience, which was embedded in the time interviewing elders and knowledge keepers and working with youth on the community farm and doing a photo voice project, I was also embarking on this canoe trip. And that intimate time without cell phones was really a large part of coming to know the meaning of food and coming to know the connection to the land and the connection of language and food, the land, and healing and cultural revitalization. That was probably the most meaningful and significant personally, which the title really speaks to my heart in that way. But I would say that participatory engaged nature was really the key part of that underpinned all the methodology, which, like I said, spoke to more that those traditional interview based approaches. But then the photo voice methodology was new for me within this project. And that was also chosen as sort of a way to stretch across culture and language
In those communities, the first language is Oji-Cree, with English actually as a secondary. Mm-hmm. So some of the photo voice was there also to help in the expression of what youth knew about food in their communities, as well as their participation and reflections on working on a community farm in order to improve and work towards food security, as well as some of these messy problems around finding employment in their communities where there's not a lot of jobs.
Sure, yeah.
So the photo voice was part of connecting across cultures, as well as allowed us to have some research materials that actually helped with revitalization of language learning. So we had the research photos that are talked about in the article that were then translated into Oji-Cree with sort of short statements on that talked about Meechum, which is the word for food in Oji-Cree. Mm-hmm. And so the photos were then turned into language learning devices that were left at the community farm and were used in tours of the farm from community members to talk about the food that was growing, as well as learning the traditional language on the farm. So there were so many spin-offs, which
yeah.
I loved.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was the most amazing part, that one thing sort of bridged into something else. And that was only, that could only be done through the time and relationship building.
Yeah, for sure. And slowing down, as you say, you know, getting rid of cell phones, which tend to isolate things from other things, whether it's information or people. That wholeness that you describe around language and place and food and interaction, sort of the performance of traditional practices, performance of new practices, but being in a relationship, being together slowly, which is something that is so rarely practiced in a lot of research, hopefully a little bit more in food studies research in Canada and Indigenous territories now. But it's very unusual, let's say, to take that much time to do the work. And then the benefits, as you mentioned, also then spin out in multiple really interesting and important ways. I thought it was also fascinating that whereas you used photo voice and photo elicitation in this research process, they don't appear in the article. And that's also, I think, surprising to some readers' minds that, well, if you captured the data, why not use it? But you have said also it was used in community. It just wasn't used in the article. And that was a question I also had for you, because you mentioned that the research was conducted within the OCAP protocol of doing research with and about Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous communities, Indigenous ways of knowing and of being. And OCAP, for listeners who don't recognize the acronym, stands for Ownership, Control, Access, and Possession. It's a whole process that researchers, particularly settler colonial researchers, are learning to engage in so that they're not conducting what has historically been very extractive research methods. And so I thought, to me, that tied in the fact that the photos weren't there, but the photos are still in community, that there is a lot of data and knowledge that has been saved in community, that's being used by community rather than being presented outwardly to a bunch of food studies readers like me.
Yeah, I would say there's a lot more to this article than meets the eye. Mm-hmm. Because of that. You know, articles often, and maybe it's just the method of delivery and the written word, but they're usually, you know, the peak of the mountain and the base is so much more and so much deeper, but it needs to be there in the sort of relational work in which this article really, really is. Having the photos still in the community was an important part of it. And when I mentioned this canoe trip we did, which is just like a few sentences in this paper, but we spent 2 weeks mapping these traditional routes and taking photos and interviewing elders who lived on trap lines along this canoe route. And I remember interviewing one elder, and it was in Oji-Cree. So I actually understood very little at the interview, but someone was translating for me and she was mm-hmm. responding. And having this audio recording of this kukumin was so meaningful to the community, and it wasn't used for data at all, but they now have this voice recording of the stories of their grandmother that I remember being one of the most significant parts of this journey, was being able to turn that data and them having that data for their own archives, which not everybody takes the time to get oral histories, right?
Yeah.
And hearing that the voices of your loved ones and those traditional stories years later, so significant.
Yeah, well, and so important as really the opposite of extractive research, about research that constructs value for the places where the places and people where the research is being done. And I think that's what's, as you say, this is the tip of the mountain that we're seeing in this article, but it's wonderful now to know directly from you how much also exists but that just isn't necessarily being shared. Because yes, much as I believe in publishing wonderful research, it also limits what you can tell and what you can say. And it also turns it into a product in a way that sometimes research shouldn't be. So what's going on now? This was, what, 4 years ago? Or 4 years ago that we published it. You've presumably been doing many different things since then. Has this research, this article, or other work that you've been doing continued to grow and expand? Are you going into new directions?
Since I finished this project, which was part of my master's research at the University of Manitoba a number of years ago, I have now moved towards more research within school food programs and more urban contexts. So an urban context certainly is different than some of this more northern remote work that I conducted in the past. But a lot of the lessons I learned through this research, which I think predominantly involve working in good relationships between non-Indigenous and Indigenous peoples, being a white settler to this land, I have carried forward with me in all contexts in which I work, including in urban centers where there many Indigenous people are found, students in our schools. And I think the biggest lesson, though, that I take from this paper, and I also practice professionally as a registered dietitian, it goes sort of back to the title of this paper, Moving Your Body, Soul, and Heart. And I don't think for one moment since conducting this research, I only talk about food within its physical substance. And that is something that I continue to model to students and colleagues within health systems, academic systems, and policy systems, that the cultural, spiritual, emotional, and land-based components of what we eat are just as important, if not more important, given the lack of focus, you know, the last 100 years on Turtle Island, that we need to begin to reclaim that embodiment of food. And for Indigenous peoples, this is instrumental to the work they're doing around healing in their communities. Yeah. But it's equally as important for non-Indigenous peoples to center and realize, because we also have a lot to gain around our health and healing when we consider food in its holistic sense.
Of course, yeah.
And opening that space of conversation to engage in our own minds and then across traditions and cultures with Indigenous peoples, I really believe is a way forward. So as much as, you know, and we know reconciliation is not just a healing of Indigenous peoples, but it's the healing of a colonial system that affect us all. As much as I work and contribute to the strengths and the resiliency within Indigenous communities, focusing on myself and leading others within more white spaces is equally important, if not more, because often we're our own barriers, our own greatest challenges towards the health and healing of our communities and planets.
You say it so beautifully, and let us all hopefully be transformed by the work that we do in the ways that you have been, and take this as a model for how any research anywhere, whether it's on food or other stuff, can help us think better, do better, act better. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for this wonderful article, and I can't wait to read more.
Thank you so much.
Courtney Vaughn is a PhD candidate at Lakehead University. During her aftertaste segment, she offers up a thoughtful and expansive response to Kaylee's article, interweaving the notion of fooding, the active participation in procuring, preparing, and sharing what we eat. It's an idea that brings together humanity, the land, air, and waters, our histories, and everything that is to come.
Ani, bonjour, hello. My name is Courtney Vaughn, and I am a Métis woman from just outside of Boating or Sault Ste. Marie. I am a PhD candidate in the Health Sciences Department at Lakehead University, and my current research focuses on Lake Superior watershed health, with an emphasis on building equitable dialogue and supporting Indigenous-led water care in the Upper Great Lakes. Much of my work focuses on land-based methodologies and pedagogies for research and education, and connecting people to land more broadly. I am in particular interested in how the canoe can act as a vessel for building equitable relationships between people, as well as between humans and our more than human kin. Michnik's article was incredibly interesting to me. She highlights how Indigenous food systems actively support ecosocial health, despite ongoing impacts from modern development such as extractive industries and industrial agriculture. I speak from my experience and knowledge as an academic, as well as a Métis woman who has been fortunate enough to be raised on the land, hunting, fishing, gathering, and gardening, I think the key to the link to indigenous food systems and sovereignty and eco-social health is that, as Michnik shares, that in indigenous worldviews, food is considered sacred. It is the way we find our place in creation. There is an inherent humility about this understanding, that we as humans are not on the top of the hierarchy of life, but are a mere part of the broader puzzle that allows life to thrive on Earth. This understanding is fundamentally different from the colonial capitalistic understanding of land, and that land, and all those with whom we share it, the microorganisms, the birds, the rocks, the air, the mosquitoes, and the moose, are meant for ownership and exploitation solely for human consumption. When you connect to land, you understand that you are a part of it. When you are on the land long enough, silent enough, and with the guidance from the people who have connected to the land before you, you see the impacts of your actions and the actions of our species on everything we touch. With such a worldview, you see that using toxic mosquito spray on your lawn doesn't just get rid of what we would deem pests, but without mosquitoes, the birds, bats, frogs, and fish have less food, and may too be poisoned by the mosquito spray. Moreover, you wonder how that spray impacts you and your family. If the spray runs off after a rain into the local water system, is it filtered out by municipal water systems? Or if you are in a well, does the ground sufficiently filter it out? If the spray reaches fish populations, does the toxin stay in their bodies? And is it transferred to us when we eat the fish through bioaccumulation? We are all connected in the cycle with what we eat. Because Indigenous people have long-standing and multi-generational relationships to specific places, this knowledge and way of living is intimately passed down from generation to generation. Getting youth on the land is a key piece to this intergenerational knowledge transfer. However, due to residential schools, forest relocations, language loss, and the various colonial impacts on Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island, this is not always an easy task. I have been very fortunate to participate in many land-based opportunities, including those passed down to me from my family, as well as community-based programs. From these experiences, as well as through the teachings of many Indigenous leaders and scholars, it becomes abundantly clear to me that in order for us to start seeing ourselves as humans inside of the web of life, that we must go out and actually participate in the web of life. Food, or rather fooding, or the act of getting, processing, preparing, and feasting, is one of the most intimate and accessible ways for us to do just that. Whether it be through participating in a community garden or going on the land with our family to hunt. Not only is this process healing for the land, but it is also healing for individuals and communities. Instead of a hierarchical system, we create a circular system, a positive feedback loop where humans heal the land and the land heals humans. It is through fooding in this way that we reimagine, or rather remember, who we are as a species and our roles and responsibilities to all our more than human kin. This is how we dismantle colonialism, the colonial mentality of hierarchy and ownership. This is how we build healthy communities and a healthy earth. So go outside, connect with the land, community, and food, and see for yourself what healing emerges. Miigwech, merci.
To be sovereign is not to be isolationist, nor autonomous, nor separate, at least not in my interpretation. Instead, it's really about being part of larger systems, while also not letting those systems take away your control, your sense of self, and the meaning that each of us both creates and shares through equitable participation. I recently read a wholly remarkable master's thesis that demonstrated how participation isn't just about being involved in something, but it's also about taking and giving and being a part of it while simultaneously changing that thing that one is participating in. It's a performance, an intersubjective interaction, and yet also a letting go of ownership and independence. It's a most beautiful concept, I think. Complex, creative, confounding, and commutative. My very sincere thanks to our engaged and expressive guests, Alexia Moyer, Kaylee Michnik, and Courtney Vaughn. Our executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Check out the show notes for links mentioned during the podcast, as well as a very lovely illustration of the beautiful but deadly cream-colored camas. Then like, subscribe, and comment on the show, please, so that everybody can tune in and digest a little food studies with their breakfast. What is it about the wild, the natural, the picturesque that seems to occupy so many contemporary hearts and minds? Why does an untouched landscape appeal to artists and historians and literary types? Is it some kind of collective colonial hangover that some of us suffer from, anchored to a history of painting and poetry in the European tradition? Is it a desire to get away from the anthropocentric or to demonstrate contrast and try to think uncomplicatedly? I don't know. Why, though, when we celebrate the impact of humanity in so many problematic ways, do we then go and celebrate humanity's absence in others? We are a messy lot, we humans.